Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway and this edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 28th of September. Our main stories. Pakistan's Prime Minister warns of a possible nuclear confrontation as a result of India's actions in Kashmir. The UN is sending experts to Venezuela to investigate allegations of executions and torture. And around 500,000 people have demonstrated in Canada alongside teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg. Also in the podcast.
Just like we practiced. Ready?
I'm always ready.
Showtime.
Today in Los Angeles, it's 85 degrees.
From Siri to Samuel L. Jackson are the many voices of virtual assistants being primed to enter every aspect of our lives. India and Pakistan have already fought two wars over the disputed territory of Kashmir. They came close to a conflict again in February this year when India bombed Pakistani territory for the first time in half a century. Tensions were defused when Pakistan returned an Indian pilot who'd been shot down. But now the mood is as bad as ever after India revoked the special status of Indian-administered Kashmir and sent in extra troops. Now Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has used his platform at the UN General Assembly to warn of a possible nuclear confrontation.
What is going to happen when the curfew is lifted will be a bloodbath. The people will come out. There are 900,000 troops there. They haven't come to, as Narendra Modi says, he's done this for prosperity of Kashmir. This is supposed to be for the development. These 900,000 troops, what are they going to do? There'll be a bloodbath.
Our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etirajan has this analysis of Imran Khan's speech.
What he wants to do is, because all his earlier attempts by the Pakistani government to internationalize this issue did not make much progress. If you look at what is happening internationally, for example, first of all, the Muslim countries, those in the Gulf, but particularly Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, they didn't issue any condemnation. If you look at other countries like the US and European Union, did not condemn India's actions in Kashmir, because what happened about 50 days ago, India suspended mobile and internet services, curfew was imposed, hundreds of thousands of soldiers patrolled the streets, and the people are still under severe restrictions. And many political leaders either under house arrest and thousands of other protesters have been sent to various jails in India. And that's why he's venting out his frustration, saying the world community is not having a proper look at what is happening in Kashmir. Now, these 8 million people are under severe restrictions and the political leaders are under house arrest and in jails. That is going to trigger anger among this public. You know, even before the special autonomy was revoked, there were regular protests and militant attacks that triggered a lot of violence. So when this anger, built-up anger comes out, when the restrictions are lifted, it is somehow going to come out, and that will lead to more clashes between people and the security forces. And that's why he was warning of bloodbath. At the same time, he's using this opportunity at the United Nations to tell the world, you are ignoring because you're looking at India as a huge market and you want to do business with India. At the same time, you are ignoring what is going on at the moment.
Briefly, he talked about 900,000 troops and also a threat of a nuclear conflict.
What he says is there are hundreds of thousands of soldiers. No one knows how many soldiers are exactly in Kashmir. But he's warning about the presence of huge number of soldiers. And as he points out in his speech that Pakistan is a smaller country, when these two countries go to war, when one country is at the edge of, not able to manage, then it will use the maximum force. And that is why he was talking about this nuclear conflagration.
Anbarasan Etirajan. The UN has agreed to send investigators to Venezuela to look into alleged human rights violations, including executions, disappearances and torture. Venezuela's official envoy said the, quote, hostile move was part of a US-led campaign. However, the decision was welcomed by the delegation representing the Venezuelan opposition at the UN General Assembly. They're there on behalf of Juan Guaido, who is recognised as Venezuela's rightful leader by many Latin American nations, the US and much of Europe. Paul Henley asked one of his delegates, Miguel Pizarro, if he felt he was on the outside looking in.
Without any doubt, it has been a hard process. And I think now most of the international community have a better comprehension of what's happening inside. And part of this challenge is to visualize and go deep in the explanations of the specific details of this nightmare that we are going through inside of Venezuela.
But does it actually make any difference, given that you're an unofficial delegation, that the US and much of Europe recognize Juan Guaido as the rightful leader in Venezuela?
Well, but that makes a difference. And I will explain you why that makes a difference. Now, even if we are not seated in the Venezuelan chair that who is supposed to be, now we have a wide spectrum of action through the member states, through every country who recognizes us. And I think it makes a huge difference. What happened today with the countries who support us and who recognize us, making the right pressure in the right space to have this kind of resolution is so important. All the countries who recognize us, making the right pressure to the recognition of the migration crisis is an important step. But also, now we're working to make the coalition grow. Now we are working with our allies to reach the other countries who doesn't understand well what's happening inside of Venezuela. We had an important conversation with the foreign minister from Morocco, for example, to ask them to have a different approach with African countries. We have a conversation with the UK Foreign Office to ask them for help to reach the Commonwealth community and to have a better explanation and a different approach. Also, we made the same with the Asian countries and with the Pacific Island countries, trying to build a new way and a new muscle of pressure, but also of recognition.
But it must be a harder and harder fight. We're 8 months on. The attempt to take power failed. Are you really moving forward?
I think we are moving forward. It of course, it's hard. It's like going up the mountain with a bag full of rocks. While this week was a high-level week with a lot of important meetings inside of my country, people is dying because they don't have food and they don't have any access to medicines. And I think we're moving forward in the same way the international community understands that the only way to have a political way out, that the only way to build an actual transition inside of Venezuela, that the only way to reach a fair and free presidential election is with the right pressure and visibilizing the right teams. I think part of our challenge is to go further and to go beyond the numbers. What means that 7 million people inside of Venezuela, an old country, a rich country, now needs humanitarian aid? That means that indigenous population is starving. That means that the kids are not attending to the school because in the house they have nothing to feed. That means that the women now are vulnerable and part of sexual exploitation nets because they are going outside of the country to look for some money to send to their families. And go deep in this explanation, go deep in the details of what means the remaining of Maduro inside of Venezuela in the power.
Can you really have a Human Rights Council investigation into alleged human rights violations while the alleged perpetrator is in power?
Well, probably all of us will have a reasonable doubt. But I think now in the United Nations councils also understands that they have to make a decision. And it happened the same with Russia and with China. This is no longer a problem only for Venezuela.
Miguel Pizarro, a member of Venezuela's National Assembly, who's at the UN General Assembly as part of Juan Guaido's delegation. It was one of the hottest political scandals of the presidency of George W. Bush, the outing of Valerie Plame as a covert CIA officer, apparently in revenge for her then-husband, US diplomat Joseph Wilson, challenging the White House's case for invading Iraq. The whole affair gripped the media for days and was later made into a Hollywood film starring Sean Penn and Naomi Watts.
My name is everywhere, my real name.
Those in the highest office thought to destroy the career of a covert agent to punish me for telling the truth.
Your wife is a traitor.
How dare you talk about my wife? You don't know her.
We know where you live.
Well, on Friday, we got the news that Joseph Wilson had died at the age of 69 of organ failure. Our Washington reporter, Tara McKelvey, told me more about how the scandal erupted.
Back in 2002, Joe Wilson went to Niger. He was there on a CIA work project, and his job was to try to see if there was evidence that Saddam Hussein had tried to obtain uranium in that country. Joe Wilson said there was no evidence of that. But then in 2003, President George W. Bush gave a speech in which he said Saddam Hussein had been trying to obtain uranium in Africa, and that he was going to use that material to build weapons of mass destruction. That was a justification for the Iraq war. And Joe Wilson said it was wrong. He published a New York Times op-ed that said, "What I didn't find in Niger." And he argued that the rationale for the war was based on a false pretext.
And then that appeared to lead to his wife being outed as a CIA officer, which meant she couldn't do that job anymore.
the Bush administration officials were very upset with Joe Wilson and with the op-ed that he had done, and they tried to discredit him. They tried to make him sound weak, and they talked about his wife, Valerie Plame, and said that she had sent him, that she had gotten that assignment to go to Niger. A columnist published her name in the Washington Post, and that's what became a huge scandal. The leaking of her name meant she couldn't work, and everyone was saying, well, who leaked the name? Who leaked the name? Eventually, it led to the prosecution of an administration official, and Scooter Libby was convicted of lying to investigators.
And it was a huge scandal at the time, sort of echoes of what we're seeing at the White House now.
Exactly. It was really, it just, everyone was suspicious of everybody, and all the journalists also became involved about which journalists had the information and the decision to make to publish this name. And the idea that you would reveal the identity of a covert operative is also certainly in the news today, whether or not that's the right decision.
And now Valerie Plame, I understand, is running for Congress.
She's running as a Democrat in the state of New Mexico, which is where she's been living for many years. And she has a campaign ad where she's shown driving this sports car through the desert backwards. And she does kind of this spin around move and says she learned those things in the CIA and that she has scores to settle.
Tara McKelvey on the political scandal surrounding Valerie Plame and Joseph Wilson, who has died at the age of 69. Many smokers in Russian cities have got used to having a cigarette on the balcony, but not for much longer. New fire regulations will ban smoking and cooking kebabs in external areas of the huge numbers of apartment blocks in Russia. Divya Arya heard more from Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor at BBC Monitoring.
It might seem trivial, but it's actually extremely important. Russia is banning smoking on the balcony.
Not everywhere.
Not everywhere, just the balcony. I mean, you can't smoke in most public places already.
Right.
But you have to remember, that's what they do in Russia. They smoke on the balcony.
Balcony of apartments.
Apartment blocks, yes.
Right.
And the reason for that is because that's how the Soviets built their cities. Lots and lots of high-rises, because they're cheap. So now, nobody's really looking forward to having to get dressed and take the lift downstairs just for a quick smoke. But the authorities are saying too many fires caused by smoking the balcony. No more of that. No more of barbecuing. Apparently, some people barbecue on the balcony. So that's banned from next Tuesday.
And how are Russians reacting?
They're fuming. One commentator online said, what's the point of having a balcony because you can't smoke there? And, well, it's a practice that's very common across the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union.
Plants and pots, I guess, in
yeah,
the balcony.
I grew up in Ukraine, and that's what comes with the territory, if you like. You live smelling tobacco smoke from the neighbours downstairs, and you watch the neighbours upstairs throwing cigarette butts down. So no more of that.
That won't be too pleasant, though. I mean, cigarette butts falling down on your head. You look at monitoring, which is basically looking at other media outlets. Have they been giving the story importance?
Oh yes. It's in the news today because clearly the government knows they need to get the message out. And it's presented in the light of, you know, we're trying to fight fires and we're trying to save people's lives.
And is there going to be some repercussion? Like, are people going to protest or they're going to just agree to what the government has said?
Well, the question is, how are you going to enforce it? Are you going to post a policeman below every single apartment block? Are you expecting your neighbours to report you to the police? There's all sorts of those questions being asked. And there's it turns out there's a group called the All-Russian Movement for Smokers' Rights, and they're predictably very upset.
Vitaly Shevchenko. Now, as you may know, Amazon's Alexa assistant is getting a new range of well-known voices.
Just like we practiced. Ready?
I'm always ready.
Showtime.
Today in Los Angeles, it's 85 degrees.
Say my name.
Woohoo! Oh, aren't we organized?
The well-known voice of American actor Samuel L. Jackson, one of many new features unveiled at Amazon's annual event in Seattle this week. Alexa will also become available in new ways, including a smart ring and spectacle frames. The BBC's Cody Godwin was in Seattle. Rory Kefflin-Jones asked her whether Amazon wants their assistant to be with us everywhere.
Yes, I think they do. The big things that they announced, and I can say this with confidence because judging by the queue at the demo space, the glasses, the Echo Frames, or what they're calling them, had the longest queue of all of the things that they announced. What they've done is they've integrated Alexa into these glasses, but not kind of in the way that we've been hearing. There's not AR being projected onto what you're seeing. There's not a screen within the lens. It's just in the frame, kind of by the sides of your ears. They have full Alexa integration with that. Another thing they announced was a ring. It's called the Echo Loop. It's jewelry, not to be confused with their doorbell device. But instead of having to use the wake word, you just hit a little button, it vibrates, and then you speak directly into it. And then you hold it up to your ear and hear what she has to say.
Just coming back to those glasses, they're called smart glasses, or people are calling them smart glasses. They're not smart, are they? As you said, that there's no screen. It's basically just a loudspeaker in the side of your glasses. So compared with, I wore Google Glass for years, which had a big problems, but that was a lot more sophisticated than this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I even asked them, do you consider these to be smart glasses? And they kind of gave the standard PR answer of course we do. They've got all these Alexa capabilities in it. So I think they're seeing it as that. I think some consumers might be more comfortable with that kind of smart glasses, at least for now, while they start to get used to the idea of wearing technology on their face.
And of course, the key thing is it takes Alexa out of the home on the move. You know, they've had a pretty disastrous time with mobile phones, but they found a way of effectively getting Alexa into mobile phones, both via the glasses and via these new earbuds.
Yeah, they're really trying to push that. And I think they're coming into a space where we have Siri in the AirPods. So there is that ability, but they're really trying to take it one step forward. Even one of the demos they showed with the glasses in particular was, it can not only direct you to the nearest grocery store, in the demo they showed Whole Foods, but it can also direct you to a specific aisle within it. So if you don't know where a certain product is, they've integrated, or they're at least working on integrating that kind of capability.
Now, this technology has been very popular, very successful, but there have always been privacy concerns about it. Some people have said, there's no way I'm going to have a loudspeaker basically spying on me in my home. Did they address those privacy concerns at all?
They did a little bit. They announced that coming a little bit later this year, Alexa is going to have a couple more commands that they're hoping will provide a bit more transparency for the consumers. You'll be able to ask, what did I just say? And she'll repeat back what she heard you say. Or if the device is triggered and you don't know why, you can say, why did you do that? Which then ideally it will tell you, oh, I heard this, or the device was triggered in a different room. So then it also turned on. So they're trying to make it a bit more comfortable. There is also the option you can tell it to delete everything that you've said that day. And then also, I think in the settings, you can set it to delete everything after a certain amount of time. So they are trying to allow customers to feel a bit better about their privacy when it comes to their devices.
Jody Godwin talking to Rory Coughlan-Jones. And still to come in the podcast. From opera shows to looser dress codes, how Saudi tourism is trying to make new moves while keeping an eye on old values. A week ago, hundreds of people took to the streets of Cairo in a rare and risky demonstration against the Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Risky because the former general has clamped down on any dissent since the 2013 coup that brought him to power. In fact, nearly 2,000 people have been arrested in the past week. A few people did protest this Friday, but the threat of force kept most off the streets. Salina Beal is our Cairo correspondent.
It's quiet. It's an eerie silence in Cairo tonight. It seems that a lot of people were too scared to take to the streets like they did last week. I mean, all the entrances to Tahrir Square have been closed. Security has been beefed up across the city. In the morning, I saw security personnel stopping public buses, asking some people to get off. They search their mobile phones. They check their ID cards. I mean, I haven't seen that strict security measures in the capital in years and years. It seems that dissent has been piling up, but perhaps the trigger behind all of that is an Egyptian contractor who lives in Spain called Muhammad Ali. He has published a number of videos on social media that went viral. He says that he has worked in construction projects with the army for 15 years and uncovered some details accusing President Sisi himself and top army generals of widespread corruption, of wasting millions of Egyptian pounds on mega projects at a time when many Egyptians are living from hand to mouth.
Sally Nabil in Cairo. The schoolgirl environmental campaigner Greta Thunberg has joined lively climate change protests in Canada. An estimated 500,000 people took part in the rally in Montreal. The teenager spoke about the criticism that she's received for raising awareness about the threats facing the planet.
I don't understand why grown-ups would choose to mock children and teenagers for just communicating and acting on the science when they could do something good instead.
The demonstrations coincided with a meeting of the International Civil Aviation Organization, an agency of the UN that gets together every 3 years to set international standards in air transport. It was due to discuss climate-related goals for the aviation industry. Amy Malarkey is from the Climate Works Foundation, a campaigning charity based in San Francisco. She told Paul Henley what she wanted to emerge from the meeting in Montreal.
Civil society does have a seat at the table at ICAO, and it provides an important counterbalance to the voice of industry, who also have a seat at the table. But largely, ICAO is set up as a membership of all the states that are members to ICAO, so all of the countries that participate in ICAO and have international aviation.
So tell me first, what is the industry proposing to reduce air travel emissions?
So the industry has a voluntary proposal to reduce its emissions, and it is targeting a reduction of 50% by 2050. Now, civil society would counter that by saying that if you listen to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report about the impacts of global warming, we need to be reducing emissions from all sectors, and we need to be doing it incredibly quickly. So aviation is going to need to do its part, just like all other industries, to reduce its emissions as quickly as possible.
But is aviation a major offender? Just put it in context.
Most of your listeners may not know just how large an impact flying has. So civil aviation commercial flights that you and your listeners take accounted for about 2.4% of all carbon dioxide emissions. But when you include emissions that come out the back of the engine and are emitted up in the atmosphere, things like soot and the contrails that come out of the engines, that adds up to 5%. Now, 5% may not sound like a large figure, but demand for aviation keeps growing. So in 2018, 4.3 billion passengers took to the skies. In less than 20 years, that's going to nearly double to 8.2 billion passengers. So while other sectors like the power sector or the road transportation sector are reducing their emissions, if aviation continues on this current path, it will essentially eat up those reductions. And so we need to find ways of reducing those emissions. And that's why ensuring that ICAO adopts a long-term greenhouse gas emissions reduction target is so important for the aviation sector. Because without a target, it's actually very difficult to measure progress.
Amy Malarkey, Associate Director for Transportation with the Climate Works Foundation. Next to a moment in history nearly 30 years ago.
The police commander on duty here at Checkpoint Charlie has suddenly announced that they can go over. They're simply charging now through the small gate in the fence.
The fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, a seminal moment not just for Germany, but Europe and beyond. During the Cold War, communist East Germany was controlled by a secret police force known as the Stasi. They ran a web of officers and informants using bugging technology and secret prisons. Now the German parliament has voted to close down the authority which holds the files on Stasi activity and move them to a state-run national archive instead. For 18 years, Dr. Hubertus Knaber ran a museum in Berlin which used to be a Stasi prison. My colleague Razia Iqbal spoke to him about the move.
I think this is a big mistake because the biggest institution, not only in Germany, but on the whole world of dealing with the past of a dictatorship will be dissolved, and also an example for other countries how to deal with the past will be eliminated with that.
Why is it so important that there is a separate
place where these files and this historical archive is kept? Because the argument from the Parliament is that this archive will be better preserved and still be accessible.
The Stasi, the secret police, tried to destroy all their documents, and then citizens went into the offices and occupied the offices, and they really struggled for conserving these documents, and they were successful at the end. And then it was decided to constitute a special institution. It was also necessary because, of course, these documents were very sensitive.
There are people who, like you, are critical of this decision and talk about a lid being put on history. For those who don't remember, remind us what the Stasi did.
They really tried to get a very detailed picture about their own people. The Minister of State Security always said, we must know who is who. That is our main question, who is who? And that means not only knowing when somebody is acting already, but knowing before what he's thinking. And therefore, they developed a very sophisticated system of getting informers, of educating informers, and also, of course, of technical surveillance, what was in use in East Germany.
Characterise, if you would, for us, what the atmosphere was like, which was created by the way in which the Stasi operated.
Fear. A blank fear of the state, of policemen, of the neighbour, even of members of your family, because there were a lot of people who had been spied by family members, and you couldn't trust anybody. When I saw my own files, I also stopped to trust other people. It was a very strange experience. I said, I can only trust one person, and that's me. And, of course, my wife was very angry with me. And a dictatorship which is constituted so much on fear to discipline the society, it's something which is also difficult to explain and to understand. And if we talk nowadays about GDR, we think of strange cars, for example, but we don't think about this feeling of fear.
Hubertus Knaber speaking to us from Berlin. Tourism and Saudi Arabia don't usually go together, but now the kingdom is opening its doors as part of a broader push to cut its economic dependence on oil. Visas will now be available for 49 countries and strict dress codes for women visitors relaxed. Religious tourism has long been expanding in Saudi Arabia, but the focus is now on the Al Ula project in the northwest, which is intended to be the first tourist resort open to non-Muslims, a step into an entirely different market. Our reporter Sylvia Smith has been discovering more about what could be Saudi Arabia's visitor hotspot of the future.
I'm flying over spectacular sandstone rock formations that stretch away into the distance as far as the eye can see. The helicopter's just about to land on a windy mountaintop where Amr al-Madani, the CEO of the Royal Commission for Al-Ula, or RCU for short, is waiting. He's confident about the future of tourism.
Al-Ula could easily pass through annually anywhere between 1.5 to 2 million visitors. So the segment of travellers we are looking for are those who have done most of the classic traditional sites around the world and looking for something new. The 5-hour plus 6-hour travelling markets in Europe will be our first focus. Europe and Russia, China, 50% of our targeted tourism will come from this area, while the other 50% will come from GCC and domestic travellers as well.
But how will local people benefit from the RCU's plans? Raed Hamid was born and brought up in Al Ula and recently trained as a guide.
Before the RCU come, the people in Al Ula used to go outside Al Ula to Tabuk or Medina to get a job. But when the RCU came to be in Al Ula, established a lot of jobs to people in Al Ula, to young people also. A tour guide, like me, the tour guide, and also the ushers.
The ushers Raed is referring to are working at a series of musical concerts held in the Al Maraya Concert Hall. It's a new, contemporary, mirror-clad structure with seating for 800. It reflects the huge rocks all around and blends in seamlessly with the landscape.
Osman,
The 2019 winter season includes the likes of Italian opera singer Andrea Bocelli. All performances were sold out, which comes as little surprise to Cameron Manwaring, an American futurologist.
One thing about Ulua, in terms of its monetary value, is the value that will bring in terms of the marketing and the perception.
So in fact, you're saying that Al-Ula can possibly rebrand the whole of the kingdom.
Saudi, in many ways, some of their weaknesses will become their strength. One of the reasons some of the sites that you've seen are so beautiful and so pristine is because visitors have not been here for decades.
But all that natural beauty, such as the monumental sandstone rocks, could be swept away by uncontrolled development. How does the Royal Commission plan to deal with that risk? Amr Al-Madani says a written commitment puts the natural world first.
We all remain sympathetic and respectful of the what we call Al-Ula's charter, is to be able to respect nature and heritage and make sure that the footprint is minimum.
As part of the 2030 vision of Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Al-Ula will be the flagship and to some extent the measure of his success in transporting the kingdom into the 21st century.
Sylvia Smith. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.